nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Thank you very much. My name is Tim Sands. I'm in the School of Materials Engineering and Electrical and Computer Engineering here at Purdue, and also part of the Burt Nanotechnology Center. I'm going to talk today about a topic that is, I think, a lot of fun. If you're an engineer, you like to design things. And in this realm of designing nanocomposite thermoelectric materials, you have the ultimate, I think, design challenge, both from the materials point of view and from the device point of view. In fact, as you'll see, one of the reasons for this subtitle is that the thermoelectric effects have been known since the 19th century, since the early 19th century. But the materials and devices were originally developed in the 20th century, the ones that have practical application. But the development of those materials and devices became stagnant around the middle of the last century, middle of the 20th century. And not much happened for several decades because of the challenges in balancing the design issues in the materials and in the devices. And I'll be highlighting that today. I'll give you a way of thinking about these materials, hopefully, and the effects involved. But I'd like to finish probably, well, good part of the talk will be on 21st century approaches. These are approaches based on quantum phenomena and based on fabrication techniques that just weren't available 20, 30 years ago. So I'll finish with, I think, an optimistic note that these materials and devices will be more prevalent. They won't be just in beer coolers and communications laser systems, but you'll start seeing them everywhere over the next 10, 20 years if some of the challenges with fabrication, mainly manufacturing, are addressed. So I think what I hope you'll get out of this is a sense of the challenge with designing thermoelectric devices and materials, and also some indication of the promise going forward. So let me quickly give you an overview of what I'm going to cover today. Solid-state refrigeration, solid-state thermal-to-electrical power generators. I'll say just a couple of words about what if. So what if we are successful in getting out of the doldrums of the last century in terms of these materials and devices? What impact would they have? Then I'm going to review the thermoelectric effects. These are probably effects that you've learned at some point in your education, but I would like to go into them with a particular perspective involving the distribution of energies of the electrons and how to think about them, I think, at least the way I think about them, and how to unify these different effects. I'll talk a little bit about the Seebeck effect, the Peltier effect. Both of these are related. I won't say much about the Thomson effect. It's also related. These three effects basically are the same, just different ways of looking at them, different boundary conditions. And then I'll introduce the dimensionless figure of merit ZT. If you work in thermoelectric materials, and some of you do, you'll know what this is. But I'd like to get into it in a little depth. Then we'll talk a little bit about 20th century thermoelectric technology. Where are we today, and where are we in terms of commercial products today, not so much the lab. And moving into the lab, the promise of nano, quantum effects, and defect engineering in these materials. So we'll talk a little bit about 21st century thermoelectric materials, recent advances, mostly since the year 2000, in the laboratory, improving the figure of merit of these materials finally. And then we'll talk about a real space thermoelectric alternative. These are metal semiconductor superlattices that are more closely related to thermionic devices than thermoelectric. But you'll see, I think, at the end that these things are connected, the effects are connected. And I'll finish with a little bit on future challenges and some opportunities. So in terms of thermoelectric refrigeration, just a quick introduction here, the hope or the advantage is that these devices are very compact. They have no moving parts, except they may have a fan. It depends on the situation. If you have a beverage cooler, thermoelectric beverage cooler that you got at Walmart, say, you probably notice it does have a fan associated with it. You have to extract the heat ultimately from the device, from the space. So it can be done passively, but most refrigeration devices have to have a fan. No environmentally harmful refrigerants, no ozone depleting refrigerants. This is something that is a significant advantage from an environmental perspective. And as I said, it's a technology that's proven in beverage coolers. If you buy a high-end automobile, you'll have an option to get a thermoelectric seat cooler. And these are produced by a company in Southern California at the level of, I think, about 1 million per year for automobiles worldwide. And they're used as temperature regulators for communications lasers. The big problem, though, is that the efficiency, or the coefficient of performance, which is a better way to perhaps talk about it in the context of refrigeration, is very low. This chart here shows various cooling technologies. Focusing here on the household refrigerators and air conditioners, we have a coefficient of performance that's in the 2 to 4 range, whereas thermoelectric refrigerators are down in a range of 1 or below. These curves here, these nested curves, represent the dimensionless figure of merit, ZT, which I'll introduce later in some detail. But let me just say here that today's technology, the materials have a ZT of about 1. The systems have a ZT in the 0.5 range. If we could get the ZT of the system up to the 4 range, then we could start talking about replacing compressor-based refrigeration with solid-state refrigeration. So we're quite a ways from that, but the potential is there. Anybody, if you haven't actually seen a thermoelectric device, this is a snapshot of one in cross-section. These are elements of bismuth telluride semiconductors, the millimeter scale. There are hundreds of them, and they're bonded together thermally in parallel and electrically in series. They're alternating N and P-type semiconductors. So it's quite a challenge to make these things, to assemble them, but once made, they're fairly robust. They last for a long time. They can handle temperature cycles quite well. In terms of power generation, which is using the same phenomena, direct generation of electrical power from a temperature difference is what we get from thermoelectric effects. It's ideal for compact, maintenance-free power plants. The Navy's very interested in this for their all-electric vessels. They'd like to go from the primary thermal source, which may be a nuclear reactor, to directly to electrical power without going through the steam plant. So they're funding a lot of work in this area in the hopes that that may be achievable. Waste heat recovery systems as well. The Department of Energy has started a couple of programs trying to use exhaust heat and convert it to electrical power, and I'll have a slide on that in a moment. It is a proven technology, just like the refrigeration technologies. The familiar application is radioisotope thermoelectric generators for deep space probes. It's probes that go off into space and far from the sun, where solar power, photovoltaics, is not feasible, have to have a compact, maintenance-free source. So use the heat generated by radioisotopes and convert that directly to electrical power with devices that don't have any moving parts. They're basically a solid-state thermoelectric material. And as I mentioned, potential for increasing the miles per gallon of vehicles and enabling all-electric vessels. But again, the efficiency is low. If we look at the similar chart here with the power generation efficiency versus temperature ratio, T hot over T cold, we see that thermoelectric power generators are down here at the bottom. So if you need them from a maintenance point of view, maintenance-free point of view, or you need a very robust technology that's compact, you might choose it still, but you're not going to if you don't have those constraints. If you don't have to make it compact and if maintenance isn't an issue, you're never going to choose this. But if ZT were moved up to, say, 4, now we're starting to look at thermoelectric power generators being competitive. As they are now, they're not, except for those niche applications. So I mentioned exhaust waste heat to electrical power. This is the typical split of the power that's initially, or the energy that's initially in the fuel, the gasoline. 25% goes to mobility, basically moving the vehicle and to accessories, more and more to accessories these days with modern vehicles. 5% is lost to friction and parasitic losses, 30% to the coolant, and 40% to the exhaust gas. So that's where the hope is. If we could mine a little bit of that waste heat and convert it back into electrical power, that would go in toward moving the vehicle and operating the accessories. So now we're going to jump from application to the basics. What is the physical basis of these thermoelectric effects? Depending on which textbook you start with or what perspective you take, whether you take a physicist perspective, mechanical engineer, whatever it may be, you'll have a different take on it. So I'm giving you the version that makes sense to me. So that's my prerogative. So let's look at an n-type semiconductor here. What I'm showing here is the density of states, just typical parabolic density of states, bulk 3D density of states, electron states, versus electron energy. And we have here the Fermi energy. Here we have the Fermi direct occupation function, the occupation of these states as a function of energy. And convolving these two, we end up with the density of occupied states, which is this blue cartoon. So if you overlay this, multiply this by this, you get this blue region. And what that says is that these are the electrons and their energy distributions that are responsible for conduction. And the average energy of these electrons is, say, about here. That's displaced from the Fermi energy. And that displacement from the Fermi energy is the basic thermoelectric effect. Thermoelectricity arises from the difference between the average energy of electrons or holes responsible for conduction and the Fermi energy. So for an n-type semiconductor, this is the picture you would have. What you'd like to do is increase this, if you could. And as we'll see later, you want to get as many states or as many electrons available as possible here. And sometimes those are contradictory requirements. But as long as we have some asymmetry in the density of states about the Fermi energy, then we're going to have some finite thermoelectric effect. Now, looking at a metal, the situation is a little more complicated. It's exactly the same thing, except for that I have to be a little more careful, a little more precise. In a metal, we have a very small asymmetry of the density of states, so we have small thermoelectric effects. If we look at the density of states now, the Fermi energy has moved up into this conduction band, well up into it. And here, the density of states, the asymmetry of the density of states about the Fermi energy is relatively small. If we apply our Fermi Dirac occupation function to this, then we end up with this light gray or light grayish blue distribution of occupied states. Now here I have to be a little careful. I didn't wasn't very attentive to this in the last view graph, but it's really not all these electrons that contribute to conductivity. Of course, it's the electrons that are within a kT or a few kT of the Fermi energy that actually contribute to conductivity. So taking that into account, it's this blue distribution of electrons that actually are responsible for conduction. And if we look at the average energy of those conduction electrons relative to the Fermi energy, because there is some asymmetry in the density of states about the Fermi energy, there will be a displacement of this average energy relative to the Fermi energy. And that will produce the thermoelectric effects in a metal. Now, they're very weak compared to a semiconductor because the asymmetry of the density of states is small. On the other hand, there are a lot of carriers here. Metals have 10 to the 22, 10 to the 23 carriers per centimeter cubed. That's a big increase over the typical semiconductor, several orders of magnitude. So keep that in mind because there is that trade-off. We'll come to that later. Okay, the Seebeck effect, discovered in 1821, is a generation of voltage along a conductor subjected to a temperature difference. Initially, the carriers, electrons or holes, will move from hot to cold, as you'd expect. That results in a potential difference opposing further current flow. So if you have an open circuit configuration and you have a bar of, say, semiconducting material, and you put that in a temperature gradient, you have a hot side and a cold side, then the electrons or the holes, depending on which way you've doped it, will flow from the hot side to the cold side. And that will give rise to the a Seebeck voltage. And the Seebeck coefficient is the voltage divided by the degrees Kelvin, so voltage per degree Kelvin that's generated in the temperature difference. So if we look at it in terms of cartoon form here with the electron energy distributions on the hot side and the cold side, as we initially allow it to relax, there are more electrons here that have higher energy, average energy, and so they will tend to flow in this direction toward the cold side, trying to balance things out. The result of that is that there will be an opposing voltage that will prevent further current flow because it's an open circuit. There's no wire connecting or circuit connecting both sides. So in steady state, the average energies will be equal in this cartoon, and that results in this thermoelectric voltage. If we drop this voltage, or if we then connect this up in a circuit, through a load resistor, we have a generator. So in the open circuit case, it's simple to see, but if we put a load resistor here or an impedance, then we will be essentially generating electrical power from the temperature difference. The Peltier effect, discovered in 1834, is driven by an applied potential. Electrons, or holes if it's a p-type material or a hole conducting metal, absorb heat from the lattice at the cold side and reject heat to the lattice at the hot side. So this is refrigeration. And the idea here is similar. It's actually the same effect, but we're looking at junctions now. And here we've got our n-type semiconductor and the electron distribution on the cold side. And here we've the electron distribution on the hot side. And what we're trying to do is move heat from the cold side to the hot side. So we're trying to make a refrigerator. The electron distribution, the conduction electron distribution in the metal, is centered near the Fermi energy. In order for an electron to make it into the conduction band of the semiconductor, it has to increase its energy, and so it has to draw heat from the cold side, and that cools this left side of the device, because heat is absorbed from the lattice, and the electrons then flow down here, and then they release that extra energy at the hot side. So you're cooling this side and heating this side. In the process of doing this, you're generating joule heat, and half the joule heat on average, it depends on what assumptions you make, flows this way and half flows that way. That's not a good thing. We don't want heat flowing back. So keep that in mind. That comes into the figure of merit. Okay, in terms of a device configuration, we usually can't get away with just one leg of material. Here's a device configuration for refrigeration. We have here essentially a voltage source or driving current in this direction. Electrons flow in the opposite direction in the n-type semiconductor. Holes will flow in this direction. So the reason that you configure it this way is if you configure it this way, you're going to get cooling from both legs, both the n and the p-type leg, by connecting these thermally in parallel but electrically in series. So the electrons are moving this way, pulling heat from the left side to the right side, and the holes are also moving this way, pulling heat from the left side to the right side. The reason you have to do that, and as a matter of fact, you do it with many of these couples, is that you need to essentially do impedance matching. The conductivity of these materials is relatively high, so if you want to run these at reasonable voltages and currents, you need to have a higher impedance overall. So the current essentially snakes back and forth across these couples, increasing the path length essentially through the semiconductor so that the impedance increases to a range where you can do load matching. So again, the charge carrier heat flow is in that direction. The lattice heat flow is in that direction. That's not what you want, but that's what you've got. So the net heat flow is from left to right. If the lattice heat flow were larger, then the net heat flow would be reversed, and that wouldn't be good. That's what you'd have with an ordinary material. You would have the heat flowing to the left. You wouldn't have a refrigerator in that case. Okay, I don't want to dwell on this, but thermoelectric device configuration for generation would look something like this. It's almost exactly the same as before. Let me just back up so you can see that. Except for that we have a load now, and we're providing power to that load with this configuration. We're from the hot side to the cold side, electrons are moving this way and holes are moving this way. Their energy, basically they're generating electrical power from the temperature difference, as I mentioned earlier. And the reason for having the P and N couples, just like in the refrigerator, is the same. We need to do load matching. We need to have a higher impedance structure. So we have to build these fairly complex multi-couple devices. Okay, I mentioned a dimensionless figure of merit, ZT. The derivation of this as being the correct figure of merit for optimizing the performance of generators and refrigerators, that theory was developed almost 100 years ago. There are a lot of things involved in this. It's optimizing the geometry as well as optimizing the materials properties. So if you want to look into this in more detail, you'll have to look at the derivation carefully to convince yourself that this really is a useful figure of merit. But I'm going to skip that, and I'm going to just tell you that, yes, this is what we want to optimize. at least in terms of refrigeration. There's a subtle difference with power generation. The thermal conductivity comes in a slightly different way. But in terms of optimizing the materials, this is a reasonable place to start. So what we have in the numerator is the Seebeck coefficient, which has units of volts per degree Kelvin, squared, the electrical conductivity, the thermal conductivity in the denominator, because we want to suppress the heat flow in the opposite direction. And then temperature makes this dimensionless. ZT equals 1 would be the typical device today. ZT equals 4, as I mentioned at the beginning, would be about what we need to make a big technology difference, to have a replacement technology for refrigerators, for compressor-based refrigeration, for power generation. So looking at these from a device point of view, we need a large Seebeck coefficient that gives us a large open circuit voltage for generators and a large Peltier coefficient for refrigerators. The larger the Seebeck coefficient, then we have a bigger offset essentially between the Fermi energy and the average energy of the electrons, so we suck up more heat from the lattice for a Peltier cooler on the cold side and we dump that on the hot side. In terms of the thermal conductivity, the advantage of having a low thermal conductivity is it's easier to maintain the temperature difference for a generator between the hot and the cold side. It also reduces conduction of heat back to the cold side for refrigerators. So that's why we want the thermal conductivity in the denominator. In terms of the electrical conductivity, we want a high electrical conductivity because we want to reduce the Joule heating. If we generate a lot of heat in the process of moving carriers through the semiconductor, we're going to end up heating up the cold side for a refrigerator, and it's wasted energy, thermal energy generated for a generator. So we want to do what we can to minimize the resistivity of the material, increase the conductivity. So that's a rationalization of why these factors are in the ZT. It's not a proof, but if you go through the derivation, it's not so complicated. You'll come up with this result. So in terms of design challenges, you know, it sounds fairly straightforward. We'll just increase the conductivity, so that would sound like a metal. We'll increase the Seebeck coefficient, that would mean an insulator. We'll decrease the thermal conductivity, that means lots of defects, but wait a minute, these things are all coupled. That's the problem. For most homogeneous materials, increasing the carrier concentration increases the electrical conductivity, but it also reduces the Seebeck coefficient, or Seebeck coefficient. And the reason for that, as I mentioned before, is that as you increase the Fermi energy relative to the band edge in a metal, generally, you will make the density of states more symmetric about the Fermi energy, and that will lower the Seebeck coefficient. That will essentially decrease the difference between the average energy, the conduction electron, and the Fermi energy. So we don't, no free lunch here. The second bullet, increasing the effective mass of the carriers increases the Seebeck coefficient, but decreases the mobility. We'd like to increase the effective mass, and that will become clearer a little later. That gives us a more steeply inclined density of states near the bottom of the conduction band. It flattens out the conduction band if we're talking about an n-type semiconductor, and that improves the Seebeck coefficient. But if we have a large effective mass, generally we have a lower mobility and therefore a lower conductivity. So that's, again, no free lunch there either. There are some ways of working around it, but that's a problem. Increasing conductivity increases the electronic contribution to the thermal conductivity. The thermal conductivity has two parts. It has the electronic contribution and the lattice contribution or phonon contribution. There's a proportionality relationship between the electronic contribution and the electrical conductivity through the Wiedemann-Franz-Lorentz law, which you may remember from elementary physics. So we can't really win there either. If we increase the conductivity, we tend to increase the electrical component of the thermal conductivity. Decreasing the phonon or lattice contribution to the thermal conductivity by adding defects, which is a reasonable way to go. You know, you can take the thermal conductivity of a single crystal material down by one or two orders of magnitude by just introducing defects. That would say, wow, one or two orders of magnitude would have a huge effect on the ZT. The problem is that it also will decrease the mobility of the electrons or holes and the conductivity, therefore. So again, no free lunch. Each of these changes that you might consider has a corresponding detrimental effect on some other part of the ZT. 20th century approaches. Well, the power factor, I didn't show up the usual curve here, but I think you can appreciate this, that the Seebeck coefficient squared times the thermal conductivity, or times the electrical conductivity, is known as the power factor. It's the numerator of ZT. This is optimal for, or optimized for, degenerate semiconductors. If we have an insulator, we have a very high Seebeck coefficient. The Fermi energy is in the middle of the gap. Any conduction electrons that are there, they might be very few, but they're going to be displaced in energy from the Fermi energy by a large amount. So we'll have a large Seebeck coefficient for an insulator. But we have a very low electrical conductivity for an insulator. So that's not the optimal situation. If we go over to a metal, we have a high conductivity, but we have a very low, as we've talked about before, a very low Seebeck coefficient. And the intermediate case, which happens to be a heavily doped semiconductor or degenerate, meaning that the Fermi energy is at or above the bottom of the conduction band slightly, or if it's a hole-type semiconductor, below the top of the valence band, maybe 10 to the 19, 10 to the 20 carriers per centimeter cubed. That's generally where we have the optimal power factor. The other approach that's been taken in the design or discovery of thermoelectric materials back in the last 5 decades or so is high mass elements, low spring constants, weak bonds, and large unit cells to reduce the lattice thermal conductivity. So we've looked for materials that are low on the periodic table, that have very weak bonds, and hopefully as weak as possible, but there's some constraints there too, and large unit cells, meaning lots of different phonon modes. That will reduce the thermal conductivity, the lattice contribution. And the other aspect that's rather easy to implement is solid solution alloying to reduce the lattice thermal conductivity. If we take two materials, two compounds, say, and alloy them, maybe they're similar structurally, we alloy them, we don't introduce a lot of extended defects, we get a lot of point defects as a result. Point defects scatter short wavelength phonons efficiently, very efficiently. So this will bring the thermal conductivity way down. So making a 10% alloying addition to a compound that's already a good thermoelectric material could decrease the thermal conductivity by a factor of 2, 5 even, and will dramatically improve the ZT. So these are the strategies that were used in the last 30, 40 years to determine the best materials for thermoelectrics. The result, and actually this was discovered not because of the engineering principles, it was basically reverse engineered, and these principles were understood later, but bismuth telluride and its alloys, alloying with antimony telluride and bismuth selenide for cooling near room temperature is about as good as you can do with a homogeneous material. So you take a solid solution alloy of bismuth telluride with antimony telluride or bismuth selenide, or both, and you really can't do much better than that. That's what nature gives you as your best choice if you follow these design principles. So what is the situation here in terms of ZT? Well, ZT in the 1950s crept up for bismuth telluride to the point where it actually got up to about 1. That's basically where it is today. It's near 1, near 0.9, say, depending on the details of the temperature and the actual composition of the alloy. But it pretty much stayed here for 3 or 4 decades. And there weren't any improvements in ZT. There were new materials discovered, but none of them had ZT above bismuth tellurides at room temperature. Just in the last couple of years, the situation has changed. We now have at least 3 good examples with ZT above 2 or in the range of 2 and creeping up to 2.5 and above. And these are laboratory results, and I'll highlight them in a moment. But this is all because the design principles have changed. The design principles we use for homogeneous materials, for alloys, were good. They got us up to 1, but we got stuck. And we had to go in and look and understand the thermoelectric effects in a little more detail and also develop some new materials synthesis techniques in order to improve on the situation. Now, I mentioned a couple other materials. Depending on the temperature that you're operating at, you may choose a different material. Lead telluride at 700 Kelvin. Silicon germanium is used for their radioisotope thermoelectric generators for deep space probes, maybe about 1,000 Kelvin, and the ZTs are relatively low. So what are these promising new approaches? Well, I'm only highlighting a couple of them here. Any one of these would be suitable for an entire talk, But just to get you started, let me start with unusual band structures. These are new materials with complex structures and complex electronic structure, for example, heavy fermion compounds. And the idea here is to engineer the density of states to give you a spike in the density of states near the Fermi energy. So if you can get a design a material that has a band, an energy band that's very high mass, that will give you a spike in the density of states. And that will allow you, at least in principle, to improve the Seebeck coefficient. Again, there's a problem with this because these are metallic materials for the most part rather than semiconductors, and the high electrical conductivity means a high high electronic contribution to the thermal conductivity. So the denominator of ZT will increase as a result of going to a metal. But the concept is correct. It's a good idea is to look for high mass, flat band density of states or electronic structure dispersion relationships to improve ZT. It unfortunately doesn't really work. There hasn't been a demonstration of any breakthrough here, but the idea carries through. The idea is a good one. Electronic crystal phonon glass popularized by Slack. The idea is to control the disorder. I mentioned before that if you put defects, just ordinary defects, dislocations, interfaces, grain boundaries, into a thermoelectric material, you will indeed reduce the thermal conductivity, and maybe dramatically. But you usually do the same thing with the electrical conductivity, so ZT doesn't improve. If you, however, engineer or really understand what those defects are doing, you can select certain kinds of defects that will selectively scatter lattice vibrations or phonons, but not electrons. And if you do that successfully, you can end up with an electron crystal phonon glass, meaning the electrons transport through the crystal without seeing these defects. They don't scatter off those particular defects, whereas the phonons or the lattice vibrations scatter easily from those defects. So it's not easy to do, but there are some examples. I'm not going to talk about these in detail, so I'll just mention that the scudderidites are a good example if you want to look into this. Scudderidite materials like cobalt triantimonide have constitutional vacancies in the unit cell. They have actually missing sites in the unit cell. There's nothing there. If you instead put a dopant that is usually a rare earth element in one of those vacant sites, it will essentially rattle around. It'll have a phonon spectrum or a vibrational spectrum that doesn't match the lattice vibration spectrum. And phonons tend to get trapped there and easily scattered, but the electrons don't really see it. So this is a very clever way to go. Actually, the real case in these materials is somewhat different, and is more complicated than what I described, but the basic idea is there. And it has resulted in improved materials. You'll see some examples in a moment where the ZT has gotten up to, say, 1.4 or even higher for some of these well-engineered electron crystal phonon glass materials. But the potential for a breakthrough into the 2, 3, 4 range is limited. What I'd like to focus on are quantum confined structures, and these are two-dimensional superlattices and one-dimensional nanowires. This work, although there are many contributors, Millie Dresselhaus and students and postdocs, Hicks, really started this field off, or at least popularized it, and they did some beautiful theory and more recently some nice experiments to verify some of these effects. The basic idea is, if we go back to this Isaki picture from 1990, that you're all, I think, familiar with. This is density of states versus energy. Here we have the parabolic distribution of density of states for a bulk material, and that's what I've been showing so far. I've been doing it vertically, but the axes have been rotated, but that's basically what I'm referring to. If we go to a quantum well, we now have individual subbands. Essentially, the confinement in the one direction, in the, say, Z direction, causes the formation of subbands, and the onset of these subbands results in a step in the density of states. If we go to a quantum wire, we have spikes with tails associated with the density of states for a quantum wire. If we were to go to a quantum dot, we would have essentially delta functions. It starts to look like a molecular spectrum, a molecular electronic energy distribution where you have discrete states. The more spiky we can get the density of states, the higher the power factor will be. That is the S squared sigma to first order. And so that's a goal worth going for. If we can increase the density of states near the Fermi energy, but do so in a way that essentially displaces the the electrons and their energy from the Fermi energy, then we can increase the Seebeck coefficient times, or the square of the Seebeck coefficient times the electrical conductivity. In terms of theory, Dresselhaus and her collaborators and numerous other groups have contributed to this over the years and have shown results like this, where we have bismuth telluride in various forms, 3D, just basically in a bulk material, then we have the quantum well, and then we have the quantum wire. And these results got people excited in the field. This was 1993, so about a little over 10 years ago, these predictions were starting to come out. Now, why is it exciting? Well, look at the figures of merits, 10, 5. I mean, we need 4 to have a major revolution, something like 4 in terms of technology. And here the numbers look very appealing. The problem is, there are a couple of problems. One is that the dimensions we're talking about are very small. For bismuth telluride, the extent of the electron's wave function is pretty small, so you really need to have a very tiny feature, very essentially at the nanometer scale, if you want to have a big effect on ZT. So we're looking here at 2, 1, 2, 3 nanometers maybe is making a significant difference for quantum wells and quantum wires. The effect is bigger for the quantum wire. The confinement is greater. Density of states is spikier, so the result is better. But these do not include the interface effects or the barrier effects. If you're trying to make a quantum wire, you have to worry about scattering off the surfaces. And so somehow you've got to account for that. If you need to put carriers into the system, you'd probably want to do this by modulation doping. You wouldn't want to actually put the impurities in the wire, or your wire resistance is going to go shooting up. So this is not an easy thing to actually do in practice. The other thing is, if you have to do modulation doping, then that means you have barriers. If you have barriers, that means you have a parasitic heat transport mechanism through the barrier. So that is a significant problem. The ZT is enhanced, though, by degeneracy, multiple carrier pockets, and K-space. I won't go into that in detail, but Millie Dresselhaus has done some beautiful work on exploiting, in the design of these materials, the actual electronic configuration and degeneracies in the pockets in indirect semiconductors. Okay, so let's look at this quantum well superlattice approach. Here we're looking at in-plane transport. We've got the wells separated by barriers. And I haven't shown the conduction band discontinuities, but the barriers will confine the electrons into these wells. This confinement, as I said before and the previous slide showed, increases the Seebeck coefficient. And the modulation doping, if you were to put the ionized impurities in the barrier and have the carriers drop into the well, that will enhance the mobility and that will increase the electrical conductivity. The interfaces could also scatter and confine phonons, which would decrease the thermal conductivity. So these blue points are indicating positive attributes of this kind of a design. The negative parts are the parasitic heat conduction in the barrier, which will take heat flow in the opposite direction you want and doesn't give you anything for it. And then reducing the barrier width, which would be desirable from the standpoint of reducing this parasitic heat loss mechanism or heat conduction mechanism, will also decrease the quantum confinement effects. It'll prevent the electron from being confined to the well. So these features here basically result in no significant enhancement in the effective ZT in practice. But cross-plane is another story. This wouldn't be immediately obvious. Why would you go across these planes? The quantum confinement is going to take you in the plane. Well, again, if you engineer the carrier pockets properly, the orientation, you can get a big enhancement here. But really, the big advantages are the band discontinuity can trap the cold electrons in the wells and therefore increase the Seebeck coefficient. So basically, you're separating the hot carriers from the cold ones, and that has the effect of increasing the spacing or the energy difference between the average energy of the conduction carriers and the Fermi energy. So it increases the Seebeck coefficient. The interfaces scatter and confine phonons as well. So that will decrease your thermal conductivity, but the barriers may reduce mobility in some cases, decreasing the electrical conductivity. Nevertheless, this is a more promising approach, as indicated by a couple of recent results I'll highlight here, one I'll spend a moment on. This shows the dimensionless figure of merit versus temperature for a whole range of materials that have been explored, some conventional materials like the lead tellurides and the silicon germanium alloy I mentioned before, and the bismuth telluride alloy down here around 1 or below in terms of ZT. But then a number of other materials that have been discovered in the 90s and the last couple of years, again, bulk materials, the zinc antimony alloy, this is the so-called partially filled scutterite I mentioned before. You can see ZT's pushing up above 1, but in the last 3 or 4 years, there have been at least 3 demonstrations, 2 shown here, where the ZTs appear to be above 2 or in that neighborhood. So this is showing some promise, and these 2 examples I'm showing here are bismuth telluride, antimony telluride superlattices, and bismuth telluride lead telluride, lead selenium telluride quantum dot superlattices. This first work was done by the group at Research Triangle Institute, Rama Venkatasubramanian and his group, and then Ted Harmon, who's a longtime contributor to thermoelectrics, many decades at Lincoln Labs, where both these materials are basically grown by thin film deposition by MBE-type techniques. Let me just highlight one of them. This is Rama's work at RTI, where the result of this bismuth telluride, antimony telluride superlattice is a conduction band and valence band offsets, which can filter electrons. If you look at their results, these blue circles here, and there's a lot of debate about how accurate these results are. The measurements are extremely difficult to make because these are relatively thin superlattice structures. Nevertheless, the ZTs look tremendous, and the question is whether the ZT enhancement is due to energy filtering, as I mentioned before, or thermal conductivity reduction because of these barriers. And I would say that's still an open issue. I would say there's more momentum leading toward thermal conductivity reduction being the main advantage of these multilayers. So although we started off with the idea of quantum confinement, we've kind of evolved to energy filtering and thermal conductivity reduction by scattering of off interfaces, and now it's looking like maybe it's the thermal conductivity in the end that is dominating everything. So I'd like to highlight then at the end here a whole different way of looking at this. We've been stuck here with degenerate semiconductors as our working material system. And I explained before why that is. It's basically a balance for the power factor between the Seebeck coefficient and the thermal conductivity. You don't want a metal, you don't want an insulator, the optimal is around a degenerate semiconductor. But if you free yourself from that idea a little bit, and you think about what you're really trying to do, what you're really trying to do is increase the asymmetry of the density of states, the occupied density of states, about the Fermi energy. You would like to essentially make a spike of electrons at an energy that's displaced from the Fermi energy. You'd like a delta function if you can get it. How could you do that other than just engineering the bulk materials and then slapping them together at the nanoscale? Well, this is an idea came from Mahan Woods and has been developed by Vache and Ali Shakuri at UC Santa Cruz. The idea is to alternate metals and semiconductors rather than to work with degenerate semiconductors. So you essentially take what was an exercise in engineering K-space, engineering a band structure in K-space, momentum space, and do it in real space. The way this works, the way this concept works, is you take metal wells that have very high carrier concentrations. Metals typically have 10 to the 22, 10 to the 23 electrons per centimeter cubed. So 3 to 4 orders of magnitude greater electron concentration than a degenerate semiconductor. Now you lace or interleave these with barriers, semiconductor barriers that are essentially insulators. And you choose them so that the barrier height is about 4 to 5 times KT. That's about where you get the optimum effect. What that does is it allows only the hot electrons to pass through over the barrier and stops the cold electrons. So if you look at the distribution, these are plots of differential conductivity, which is similar to what I showed before, but it's basically the energy distribution of the electrons involved with the contribution to the conductivity. So you look at a semiconductor like an aluminum gallium arsenide alloy, you see that the average energy is displaced relative to the Fermi energy, but by a small amount. This is an EV. In a metal, there's a large displacement. I'm sorry, the Fermi energy is very large compared to the bottom of the conduction band, but the conductivity is somewhat balanced and symmetric about the differential conductivity about the Fermi energy. So that if you look at the average energy of the conduction electron here, it's very close to the Fermi energy. But what about if we combine these two materials and interleave them? We end up with a spike in the differential conductivity. And these are the carriers that can make it over the barrier between the metal and the semiconductor. But we're only using a small fraction of the 10 to the 23 carriers, but that's okay because that's a lot of carriers. So this gives us a differential conductivity that looks almost ideal. That's what we want for a thermoelectric material. But we've done it without a degenerate semiconductor. It's an alternate metal insulator or metal semiconductor multilayer. So this energy barrier filtering idea with high electron densities in the metal gives you essentially a large moment, if you want to think of it that way, of the differential conductivity about the Fermi level. So it gives you lots of carriers and a large displacement relative to the Fermi energy. So that's a high power factor. The other advantage is that we have a high interface density, since it's a multilayer, large mismatch in the phonon density of states between the metal and the semiconductor. And we also have another term I won't discuss here that Arun Majumdar has done some work on. All these factors suppress the thermal conductivity. And I've got to wrap it up here, but I just want to point out a couple of things. The modeling suggests that if the parallel momentum is not conserved, then we should see a dramatic enhance in the ZT over what we are seeing in bulk materials or even in semiconductor multilayers. If it is conserved, then we don't get that advance. So this is a big issue that's being addressed right now in a number of research efforts. There's a lot of suggestion that this is both theory and experiment that this may indeed be the case. But if you're interested in it, we can talk about it offline. But this is the problem of the quantum reflectivity of these interfaces. And we see for a particular combination of metal semiconductor multilayers that we're working on here at Purdue, these are gallium nitride, titanium nitride multilayers, that if we look at a, say, 900 degree Kelvin hot side, and we look at adjusting the barrier height to be about 4 or 5 kT, we end up with a ZT in the range of 4, which is where we want to be. At this stage, we're figuring out how to make these materials. This is a gallium nitride, titanium nitride multilayer grown by reactive pulse laser deposition in our lab. And I don't have time to talk about this in detail, but it behaves the way you would expect it to. At this stage, though, we are still far away from proving the theory is correct. But we do see some interesting behavior in terms of the thermal conductivity versus multilayer period, where we see a thermal conductivity minimum. And this is getting us excited about maybe shedding some light into the wave versus particle nature of the phonons, which is more important. Do you think of these as waves or do you think of them as particles? And a whole other area that I won't discuss because of time is thermoelectric nanowire heterostructures going one more step. So I'm going to skip through a few of these slides, but this is some of the work we're doing on nanowire arrays, bismuth telluride alloys in nanowire form. And there's a lot of promise here, but big challenges. We have to replace the template, this porous anodic alumina, with a lower thermal conductivity material if this is to be successful. And we're doing some strain engineering, not just our group, but a number of other groups, and nanowire heterostructures that opens up the design space a bit. And I'll skip that, and let me just go to my closing thoughts. Number one, despite the coupled factors in ZT, new approaches to these artificially structured nanocomposites give us substantial optimism that we can improve the thermoelectric device performance. A couple of the things I mentioned today are quantum confinement to enhance the density of states near the Fermi energy, modulation doping to improve carrier mobility, high interface density to reduce cross-plane thermal conductivity, controlled potential barriers to separate hot electrons, and metal semiconductor superlattices for real space engineering of the differential conductivity. The real challenge here, besides the engineering and design that goes into this optimizing performance, is going to be manufacturability and cost. Most of the structures here are nanoscale. They're made by techniques that really aren't appropriate for bulk materials or for large-scale manufacture. So we've got a lot of work to go here, and that's where the work on electrochemical methods is that I just quickly scanned through has some promise. But success will mean more efficient vehicles, potentially air conditioning systems and refrigeration systems that do not involve ozone-depleting refrigerants, and that are much more compact and reliable than we have today. So thanks for your attention, and if you have any questions, I'd like to be happy to try and answer them. I realize I raced through a lot of material here. I skipped through some things I really wanted to talk about, but at least we got partway through. Yeah.
I'm just curious, structure-wise, what would be... I noticed, you know, you spent some time on looking at how you did the N-type, P-type setup, the parallel type of thing. What would be the structure used? Has anyone thought about that with the nanowire applications?
Yeah, there is the same kind of design principles are going to apply. There will be an optimal geometry. The ratios of the heights and the widths of these elements has to be optimized. And what we're trying to do is figure out strategies for templating or electrodepositing N and P-type nanowires with the right aspect ratios in the same template. So in terms of our approach, that's what we're trying to do. There's another group in Asia that's doing a similar kind of thing. And I think there are a lot of people thinking about this. But yeah, if you want to make an efficient device that is practical, that can be impedance matched, you're going to have a similar structure, I think. I don't know how to get around that. It's going to have to be a longer path for the electrons and thermally in parallel. So big challenge. Coming up with, you know, a lot of these confined structures can be made N-type or P-type, but doing them both in the same, essentially the same form factor is a difficult challenge. It's not that you can't make a thermoelectric device with only one type and without, and you can still, it can be sloppy with the shape, but it won't be an efficient one. Any other questions? Okay, well, you know where to find me, so if you have any questions, feel free to stop by and we can talk about it. Thanks.